All right, my name is Amber Duke, and today is Tuesday, July 26, 2011, and I'm interviewing Mr. Eddie Davis at the Carl Braden Memorial Center. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Can you say and spell your name for me?
Eddie Davis, E-D-D-I-E-D-A-V-I-S.
All right, can you tell me when and where you were born?
Louisville, Kentucky, 1950.
So you've lived here your whole life?
Correct.
All right. Do you want to talk about your educational background at all?
Most of my education took place in the West End. I went to Holy Cross, which is right down the street at the corner of 32nd and Broadway. That's the grade school that I went to. And then from there, I went to Flagey High School, which is at the end of Broadway. Mm-hmm. And from there, I went to Jefferson Community College and then to U of L.
And what was your major at U of L?
Fine arts.
Okay, great. Do you want to talk about any your professional life a little bit?
Most of my professional life has been involved with newspaper work, newspaper photography. And freelance photography. I've done some things in between. I've worked in the family business. And I've worked in the beauty supply business, manufacturing. I also am a product of Acorn. I did a stint with Acorn at one point in time. I worked for Ford Motor Company at one point in time. Currently I'm working as a freelance photographer.
Okay. How did you first learn about race and racism?
The hard way. My mother is from Louisiana, and my parents used to drive from Louisville to Louisiana, and as you drive through the South, we had one of those incidents where even, you know, because my mother is a very fair complexion and has straight hair, and my father being a dark-skinned African-American with short hair. We at one time the police stopped us and asked my father where was he going with that white woman. Then when there was the experience of being in Louisiana and going to a Kresge's, I think it was a Kresge's or one of those five and dime places that have a bar, and being rejected at a very early age, you know, the black waitress tells you that they don't serve color.
Mm-hmm. And so how did your parents kind of talk to you about those issues?
They didn't.
Did they talk about political or social issues at all when you were growing up?
Not much.
Were there people who were inspirational to you that you really looked up to as you were growing up?
Carl and Ann Braden.
So you knew of them early on?
Well, like I said, I went to grade school down the street, mm-hmm. and a lot of times I've had to pass the building. Even though I didn't know what went on or what this place was about or what the Kentucky Alliance, or it may have been called SCEF SCEF back then, but it was always a center of political activism.
What was the first political or social justice issue that interested you?
Vietnam War.
How so?
While I was attending U of L, I was drafted, and that was during the Vietnam War. And one of the first places I came to for help to avoid the draft was the Kentucky Alliance.
And so how did they help you through that process?
They hooked me up. They knew the right people. They knew the right organizations to contact that could help me get through this situation.
So was that your first involvement with the Alliance?
As an adult.
Okay. And so as a young person, were you involved or just, you know, kind of walking by and seeing what was going on?
You know how kids are. I mean, there's nothing really pressing. I mean, there's plenty of racism going on. I mean, you heard about Fountain Ferry, you heard about Blue Boar, you heard about, nothing new for Easter. But you was too young to actually go and be in that mix.
Mm-hmm.
Even though you heard it was going on, it was kind of somewhat removed from you.
Mm-hmm.
But, you kind of knew, it's kind of like you hear about it, but to actually experience and be there is something else. It's a whole different experience. And, it's just like one thing happens after another and then, the light bulb goes off.
And so can you remember back? I know it's sometimes hard to think about, you came to the Alliance, they were helping you with the drafting situation.
Right.
When did you sort of transition from coming to them for help to actually being a member or a part or an organizer as part of the Alliance?
They don't call Ann mother for nothing. Ann just had always had an attraction for young people, people with political ambitions, and she was always very nurturing to a lot of people. And a lot of those people went on to, are now holding political office. I mean, a lot of them got their start right here at the Kentucky Alliance because of Ann Braden's, ability to teach and inspire.
So you were one of those young people that sort of like fell under her wing.
Yeah, that's about the best way to put it. Because she always had something for you to do. If you was going to hang out here, she had something for you to do, and then you kind of get that exposure. You get that exposure to the movement, and then it's just one thing after another.
Can you think back to the actual? I mean, you're still active with the Alliance now, but can you think back to the year that you would say that you became active with the Alliance?
No, I really can't, because it was kind of like, this was kind of like the neighborhood house. And even if you weren't an activist, the people would just stop in just to see what's going on, see what's hanging on the walls, and just, be friends. Because, Ann was friends with everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just part of the culture. At that time, that people would drift in and out of the Alliance because of the type of activities that went on. I mean, there was JOMO, the Black Panther Party, the Rainbow Push Coalition, and on and on and on. There's always something or some group that would spring up around a particular issue, and even if you didn't understand the issue, they would teach you about the issue, and then, it's just over a course of time or over evolution, you become, radicalized without really knowing it.
Sneaks up on you.
That's about it, yeah.
You named some of the different initiatives of the Alliance, talking about the Rainbow Coalition. And
yeah, that's the office, which is now the Office of the Black Caucus.
What were some of the major, over the years that you've been with the Alliance, can you talk about some of the major issues the Alliance has gotten involved in the city and nationally?
I don't know. I'm sure you know the history better than I do. I mean, you know, police brutality at one time was always a hot issue. We would tackle just about every police brutality case that we could possibly handle. We were dealing with it. Busing, integration, fair housing, gay rights, equal representation. I really can't think of a major social justice issue that we didn't deal with. We kind of think that we set the stage for the city bringing Chief White to Louisville. And once Chief White became chief of police, police brutality just kind of almost disappeared. It's almost like citizens against police abuse almost went out of business, because there really weren't any major things happening, and it seems like he turned the force around.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, over the years, the Kentucky Alliance kind of set the stage for that to happen, because at one time, it was just totally unacceptable for a black man to have that kind of power in this town.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't think anybody really thinks about it. So we're kind of like part of the cultural mindset change. Probably current issues. We opposed privatization. We opposed privatization of jobs by the city. We didn't want the city to lay off employees and then privatize their job to a private company for less money. We figured the city should step up to the plate like everybody else. And plus, these have been employees for 15, 20 years, and just because they want to save a few bucks, they want to attack the working class. I think the Alliance has a reputation of defending the working class across the board, black, white, gay, or straight. LG&E, we were the first activist organization to pursue and promote public ownership and local ownership of LG&E. Abramson also proposed city ownership of LG&E because he knew it was a cash cow. So why can't the consumers be the owners? So, of all the other social justice organizations, the Kentucky Alliance is the only one that I knew that took that lead on that issue. We also were the only social justice organization to actively oppose the merger. I personally attended a hearing with Ann Braden where she argued against the merger based on the fact that it took 100 years for African Americans in this community to develop the political clout that they had at that point in time, and that the merger was going to erode it like overnight just to justify some business interests. I mean that's in the paper. Where was everybody else at? Ann Braden personally in her 80s went door to door campaigning against the merger in the West End.
Mm-hmm. You kind of have talked about how the Alliance has really been an organization that's taken the lead on a lot of issues, but I also know that the Alliance has been a convener of a lot of different social justice groups. So how would you describe the relationship of the Alliance to other social justice organizations in town?
We're very strong on coalition building coalitions around issues. We like to try to sometimes have to take the lead because we have no other choice. our preference has always been to try to bring our coalition partners together to work as a team. It doesn't always work because sometimes other organizations don't get it, or it's not their niche, or they feel overwhelmed, or they just don't think it's their place to form this coalition. I mean, that's one of the things that the LG&E issue taught me. The LG&E issue about local ownership is really about protecting the working class. Why should profits generated in Kentucky go to Wall Street? Why can't they stay at home? It's like the water company. Because the water company is locally owned, the city was able to borrow, what was it, $10 million to cover themselves? Our mayor, Abramson, he knew that if we owned LG&E, we would have some backup. We could keep the cash cow at home. I just don't understand why the other social justice organizations that represent have a strong working class constituency, why didn't step up to the plate? I mean, that was the time to really jump on it. But trying to sell coalition politics has been difficult. Sometimes you can make it work, and sometimes it's an uphill battle, and you just have to take the lead. And hopefully, the rest of the tribe will catch on. Mm-hmm. But right after, case in point, right after the merger passed, we knew that the grassroots was going to lose a lot of political clout. The first thing that we did was try to form the Coalition for the People's Agenda, and kind of try to bring all the social justice organizations together under one umbrella to work collectively on issues that we could work collectively on. I mean, it was a very innovative approach in this city. You know, we're going to bring all the social justice organizations together, and we're going to discuss everything we have in common that we can work together as a coalition, which will give us more political juice. Which is Ann Braden's last major project that she initiated that I can remember, was the Coalition for the People's Agenda, which we're still trying to revamp, as we speak. We didn't have that problem with probably with police brutality case situation. Seems like it was really easy to build coalition when, kids get shot in the back or something. It has to be extremely tragic, something like that. we're able to, build a coalition, but when it comes to domestic policy, which, I think the history of the Bradens speak for themselves, that they basically dealt with domestic policy that affects the working class across the board. And, sometimes you got organizations, we specialize in international politics. International issues is our niche. And then you have, gay issues is our niche. Labor issues is our niche. Fair housing is our niche. Well, but it all works together. In terms of social justice, it's just bringing people together to show them where they're going to have more political juice to get what they want as a collective, rather than, that's my niche and I'm going to stay right here. Mm-hmm. It's an ongoing project. I'm really, I'm happy to still be working on it, along with my colleagues here at the Alliance. And hopefully we'll make this a reality at some point in time. One of the other things that we launched that out of the alliance is we initiated the incorporating the city of West Louisville, which I thought was pretty innovative.
No one has talked to me about that. Tell me a little bit about that.
It was during a time when we was having some police brutality problems, and we was wondering, well, how can we solve this problem? I says, you know, Sterling Neal was here, and you know, some of my other colleagues, and we were saying, well, what if West Louisville had its own police department like Shively? I said, Shively's got a police department. St. Matthews has got a police department. City of Audubon's got a police department. I says, well, what if we had our own police department that specialized just in West Louisville, and that's their specialty? Well, he said, well, in order to do that, we'd have to have an incorporated, we have to be an incorporated third-class city with our own city council. And that's how that movement got test marketed or got launched. It was out of the alliance. Because one of the things that Ann taught people is to think outside the box and to come up with some new way of accomplishing social justice. You got to think out of the box, and you got to come up with, you got to kind of like seize the moment. What is it that's happening now that you can make work to your advantage? Or how to use that window of opportunity. So as you know, City of Shively is still there. St. Matthews is still there. City of Audubon is still there. You know, you got, 92 city councils, none in the West End. So it's where's the equal representation? Still a problem, but it's still one of those projects that's still kind of like still on the drawing board, but it did get some attention. It got a lot of discussion, but they thought we was a separatist movement. You would have thought we were Marcus Garvey or something. Who's gonna run it, and who's gonna pick up the garbage, and you know, it. Interesting dynamics, but that's one of the things I like about the Alliance. They do some innovative things, or they teach you how to do innovative things to create social justice, or create that, you know, the climate that moves towards, you know, a new social order or a new consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for sharing that. I hadn't heard about, no one had told me about that movement yet. I think one of the things I've learned through these interviews is a lot about community organizing and the difference between thinking about, you know, how things happen in the business world, and this person is the boss, and this person's the administrator, and this person does this. And it seems like community organizing, that you come into an organization like the Alliance, and you know, you're helping doing things in the office, and you're making signs, and you're also in the streets, and you might also have to talk to the media, and you know, everyone is doing a little bit of everything. And maybe of the people I've interviewed, I know that you've been involved on many different levels, but would you be, I consider you sort of the photographer, of the Kentucky Alliance. So I'm just interested to hear, well, one, if you would agree with that comment and with that characterization.
Originally it was Tom Moffitt. Tom Moffitt probably has the most extensive collection of Alliance pictures. I'd say his stuff probably needs to be archived, if they haven't been archived. I still do what I can, but sometimes it's kind of difficult to do two things at one time. It's like, you know, it's like trying to be the recording secretary, listen to what's going on, and think about what's happening at the board meeting, and then try to figure out, well, you know, what are we going to do about this, or try to think out the box.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, the last probably the last project that I worked on was a press conference dealing with Judy Greene. The feedback that I was getting from the Black Caucus, which I'm the chair of the Black Caucus of the Kentucky Alliance, and all my colleagues said, we can't remain silent. We have to say something. You know, I would always tell them, well, I said, by now, Ann probably would have had 3 press conferences and wrote 6 articles. So at least we can do 1. And so anyway, we formed Concerned Citizens for District 1. So we had a meeting to plan the press conference. We invited James and Judy. They both showed, stayed a couple hours, explained to us their side of the story, what's going on, what we could do to help. We decided to have the press conference. Maddie Jones showed up, Gracie showed up, Kathleen Parks, myself, Jesse Harris, Tom Moffitt. Our slant was, let's make the process fair. Let's put the brakes on the lynch mob. Let's let the appeals process play out to make it fair. What if she wins her appeal? In the process of her going through the appeals process, they're going through the impeachment process simultaneously. And if you look at the charges, nobody that I know of believes that those charges, even if she's guilty of it, merits impeachment. Pass-through grants are common practice. So all we've saying was, let's just make the process fair and let the appeals go through. And not allow her to be, tried and convicted by the media for the purpose of selling newspapers. And that was our position. That and to try to get District 1 voters more involved. That's why we called ourselves the Concerned Citizens for District 1. Because they should have, you know, because we feel we want to empower, no matter what happens, even if she's impeached, we want to empower the voters of District 1 and not allow them to be disenfranchised by, you know, political warfare. Which I thought was pretty creative, and we was thinking out the box. Rather than have a prayer vigil, we're coming up with a real political strategy that would help the voters in District 1 and the office. I think that's what Ann Braden would have done. Of course, she would have been a lot more forceful, and she would have had 2 or 3 press conferences, and people are not going to tell her no. And, now that she's not here, you gotta wrangle with people, because some people say, well, we shouldn't touch it. And then, you know, the caucus say, look, we just can't remain silent. That is not in keeping the tradition of this organization. Mm-hmm. So I think that's one of the beauties of the Alliance is, as an institution, it allows community organizers and community activists a place to operate and try to educate people and get them to look at other viewpoints and other possibilities.
Mm-hmm. You said that you're the chair of the Black Caucus of the Kentucky Alliance, and one of the things that's really neat about this organization is the fact that there's always been this focus of it being a multiracial organization, of making sure that there's a balance of black and white, and as from what I understand, that there's work going on to get Louisville's growing Hispanic population involved so that the makeup of the organization is representative of the makeup of the city. No one has talked to me about the Black Caucus. So can you kind of describe the racial makeup of the alliance and how, you know, blacks and whites, you know, work together in this organization?
The caucus is just a caucus, and it's primarily a way of channeling a viewpoint, because most of the African American members actively live and work in West Louisville, which means we have a different social environment or a different social background. The social makeup of West Louisville is not the Highlands. It's a whole different social makeup or social environment that people operate that live in the Highlands. So people do, because of where people live and their social backgrounds, tend to shape them and give them different viewpoints. One of the interesting things I experience about, you know, dealing with the Judy Greene situation is that East End white liberals had a different position. It was almost like the board was split. And it's not like one was opposed to the other. It's just that some people don't want to touch it for whatever reason. They think it's too much of a hot potato. And other people think that, the District 1 voters are being disenfranchised by the power structure, and we need to take a stand. And and the alliance makes room and accommodations for those differences, and we still operate. Mm-hmm. It's about due process, and due process works for everybody. I mean, you know, it's no accident that Fisher, by executive order, passed the ordinance allowing gay partners to have equal benefits. Had equal benefits as married heterosexuals. I mean, that's just politics. I mean, you know, you lobby for what you want. You work the system as much as you can, and sometimes it works to your advantage. I mean, that's the payoff of working in politics and being an activist. So, what I'm saying is they're all working class issues, and they really represent the best interest of everybody that's a worker. So it's not a division based on cultural background or where you live at. It's, you know, it's like LG&E bills. Everybody pays an LG&E bill. That's just the way it is. I mean, you know, they only come in one, you know, one form. Mm-hmm. So, I would say that we're probably more issue driven, as opposed to, well, how do the Hispanics fit in? Well, they pay LG&E bills too. However, I do know that they do have a community center, they do have a political base, much like the gays, much like labor unions, and various other groups, CLOUT. I mean, you know, there's all kinds of niches based on different things. That doesn't mean they're opposed. It just means that, you know, that's just kind of like, people have things in common based on their social background. I mean, police violence is police violence. Even if it's police violence against Hispanics, gays, whoever, police violence is police violence.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, you know, there's certain issues that we come together on, and certain issues we have to do outreach. And we're always doing outreach. Of course, right now we're you know, terribly understaffed, terribly underfunded. We can barely keep the LG&E and, you know, things operating. But, I mean, we do a lot of outreach. For instance, I've been working with Ike Thacker, and we've been going out trying to recruit organizations to become more active in the Coalition for the People's Agenda. I mean, we go to other people's board meetings. The last one I went to was a fairness board meeting to meet and greet and to explain to them what we're doing and why we want their participation. We do that with other groups. CCDS, Committees of Correspondence for Democracy and Socialism. So, I mean, that's part of it, is doing outreach, but, I mean, it's not like we're, you know, excluding anybody, especially, you know, when we're dealing with broad-based issues.
Mm-hmm. Have you made friends while you've been organizing here over the years at the Alliance, and can you talk about some of the relationships that you've built with people?
The core group, basically all the veterans I've been working with, you know, the Tom Moffitts and the Bob Cunninghams and the Howard Owens and Kirk Owens, and you know, I say the majority of the older members. It's almost like we have this is kind of like part of an extended family.
And I know you've talked a lot about Ann Braden. I know that she was very special to you. Do you want to talk about your relationship with her over the years?
I could say I was, at one time I was working as kind of like a volunteer assistant, driver, gopher. You know, take me to the drug grocery store, run this to FedEx, do this, do that. And, you know, that kind of brings you into whatever the project is, and pretty soon you're part of the project and you begin learning and growing. I'd say I was probably in and out on a daily basis probably the last 2 years of her life. I was probably here almost on a daily basis. Basically, working on the projects that I had mentioned. Mm-hmm. Anne had a way of calling you up in the middle of the night and leaving you 3 or 4 messages, or giving you dictation over the phone. You wake up in the morning and you had your marching orders.
Mm-hmm. And so how, I know that a lot of people have talked about the struggles that the Alliance faced in the wake of her death. And I've talked to people. How do you think the Alliance has been able to survive and continue to work after her passing, because she was such a force here?
I'd say the kind of like the last apostles. I think that there's been enough people to work with her intimately on an ongoing basis. You know, people like myself, Kirk Owens, Howard Owens. Plus, Ann was big on recruiting. And I can say I've personally recruited at least 3 to 4 board members. You know, one of them is a co-chair. And I've been able to bring some new blood into the organization that I've really been impressed with. And I think that's part of why we've been able to keep going, is because there are enough activists out there that want to work for the Alliance and know who Ann and Carl Braden are and know how they were tireless about social justice and protecting the working class, and they want to step up to the plate. And I really don't think there's a shortage of volunteers. I just don't think there's enough recruitment. But you know, we do have a core group here that has made some things happen. I mean, you know, despite it, there are people that understand what the Bradens were about, and they know how to capitalize on windows of opportunity, and they know how to move on issues. It doesn't always work that way, but you know, we try to operate as activists in the tradition of Carl and Ann Braden. You know, which means you got to pay attention to the news and follow the newspaper and look at every issue and study politics and politicians and history, and it's an ongoing process. But most of us that spend a lot of time around Ann, you know, we kind of, you know, picked it up like it or not, it's almost ingrained in you. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, we used to watch her, how she operated, and technology's changed, but, you know, the political ideologies have not.
Mm-hmm. I know that the Alliance has worked hard to work with young people, and through the Arts and Activism Camp over the years has tried to, you know, approach this project of educating young people and getting them interested and involved in politics. And I mean, you're talking about recruitment of new members. Do you have any comments about, you know, some of the challenges of getting young people involved and keeping them involved in the work?
To be honest with you, most of the people who I've been able to recruit are sort of bring into the fold or bring on board are people who are already politically radicalized. They're just looking for a base of operation or an organization that they can express themselves through. Mm-hmm. Which means these are people that I don't have to teach them. I need to bring them in and say, hey, your agenda is our agenda, and you know, we can help each other and try to build a base that way. It's always good when you can find a young person that has some type of political ambition and is willing to learn. I just somewhat removed from them. That's a tough question. I don't know. I think something has to happen that causes the light bulb to go off for people politically. You know, one of the things we were trying to do in the Judy Green press conference is try to educate people. There are options. That seat, that Metro Council seat, belongs to District 1 and its voters. It doesn't belong to certain individuals on the Metro Council that want to control it. You do have a voice. That includes young people. Mm-hmm. Even if they can't vote, if they live in District 1, they own a piece of that seat. Everybody that voted owns a piece of that seat. So they don't really have to roll over. They really can step up to the plate collectively. And one of the things that the Alliance does is to try to motivate and try to organize grassroots people to be in power. I really just haven't worked enough with young people. It's almost like I'm too busy being in the middle of a political war. And it's been a political war here, you know, to keep the organization alive, viable, on the cutting edge, and looking at the right issues. That's a struggle. Everybody doesn't agree for whatever reasons. I mean, you know, the East End people think one way, the West End people think another, the socialists think one way. You know, your mainstream two-party system people think another, and we still try to bring it together as a collective, and it's a struggle. That's how it is.
You know, you talked about how you've been in this political war for so long, and I think the thing that's interesting about community organizing is that it doesn't pay well, and it's not a 9-to-5 that you clock in at a certain point and then clock out at a certain point. It becomes a 24/7.
It's 24/7. I mean, you know, you heard the president. I mean, the president was very clear about what time it is. He's very clear about the Republican Party, you know, which was another brainstorm because we wanted to discuss why is it that Mitch McConnell is so anti-working class and he has so much presence on an urban university that works to educate working class students, and he is so opposed to working class values and the working class. Those are questions we have to raise. Those are questions Ann Braden would raise.
Mm-hmm. How over the years has your family life been impacted by all of this activist work, community organizing work that you've done?
Well, I tell you, when my last wife walked out on me, as she walked out the door, she said, "You don't belong to me. You belong to Ann and Buster." No, she really said that and meant it. That was during the time when Busta and Ann were like working like every day. They were like, you know, every day they were working together. They had something going on. I mean, you know, the Alliance and the Justice Resource Center was always on a roll. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people don't realize how much work the Alliance did when Reverend Coleman was alive. Reverend Coleman depended on Ann Braden for a certain amount of advice and a certain amount of administrative support. And they worked closely together till they departed. But it was a good run. I tell you, they had... they kept a lot of activists busy. And they kept downtown Louisville and the powers that be on their toes.
Mm-hmm. As we start to come to a close, is there anything that you'd like to share that you haven't had the opportunity to talk about yet?
I think the future is bright for an organization like the Kentucky Alliance, because we're able to deal with issues that really affect a lot of different organizations, and we still try to bring different communities together. We have international events here. I mean, there's, you know, the type of events that take place in the Braden Center take place no place else in Louisville. We're still really an international center, international political center. And this building is really a historical landmark. You know, based on the history of Carl and Ann Braden. I mean, if you look at the work that they did during their lifetime and all the activities and events and organizations that worked through and out this building, it's a major resource for this town, and I would welcome seeing this building declared a historical landmark.
Yeah, it is a really unique space. Especially a lot of people have talked about in the interviews how this is really one of the only spaces in the West End that consistently a lot of white East Enders, white liberals, this is the place in the West End, if they're going to spend time in the West End, that this is the place where that happens.
It is. It still is. We still take on the issues that nobody wants to take on. I remember there was a gay man was shot to death. He was in drag. They shot him down for sport. We took on the issue. I don't think they solved the murder, but at least we took on the issue. All I can say, I'm not going to name the other organizations, but, we work with our coalition partners. But there's so many organizations that just won't take on the hot button issues. They, for whatever reasons, it's just taboo or something. I think we have a bright future, but we got to get some new people in. We got to get some fresh blood, and we got to get some more funding. Some more, we're still doing great. We just can't move as fast as we want to. And we can't really effectively manage all the issues that we want to handle.
More people and more money, that's what we all...
The issues are there. We try to make policy changes. And you have to lobby for policy change.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything else you want to add?
No, you got any?
That's all.
Questions? Okay.
Thank you so much.
Well, I really feel honored to be a part of this project, and whatever I can do to help, let me know.
I will.
And if you've got any additional questions that you think of.
Yeah, this was great. There were several things that you mentioned that hadn't come out of the other interviews. So that's what kind of keeps me going. Every interview, I learn something new or hear about something new that I haven't heard about in another interview. So.
Oh, yeah. We also have this joke about the men that have slept with Ann Braden.
I've not heard this joke.
You haven't heard that one?
No.
Oh, yeah, I slept with Ann Braden. Actually, some people did sleep with her because, she used to stay here and sleep on the couch.
Yes.
She became very ill, and we kind of would take shifts sleeping in the building with Ann Braden because she wouldn't go anywhere.
Wow. That's interesting. I have heard the story from Bob about Ann doing yoga here in the building.
Yeah, she used to have an exercise bike right there on the floor, she had her exercise bike and she got into yoga.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, I've heard Bob tell the story several times of her. He came in and she was in some sort of yoga pose on the floor with her eyes closed. And he thought, oh my God, she's died. And, he went over to her, but she was just doing yoga at the time. You'll have to ask him about that story.
I remember seeing her do yoga.
Mm-hmm.
Any more questions?
No more.
Okay. Well, thank you again for letting me participate. And whatever else I can do to help, let me know.
I will.
I will say this. Mm-hmm. This is one thing that I think needs to be mentioned, that, mm-hmm. that anybody that knew Ann Braden, Ann Braden had a way of letting you know she was always and always will be married to Carl Braden. I mean, they were a political couple, a unit. And which I thought was really interesting, because I never met somebody that was just, you know, it's almost like he was, you know, he's not here, but he's really here. And she just had a way of letting you know that.
Mm-hmm. They were like a power team.
Yeah, right, right.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I